Welcome back to The New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcast. This is podcast 371. In this podcast, I've decided that it is time for a frank discussion about Iraq, the so-called Islamic State, Syria, the region in general, and foreign affairs in general. And when I do these podcasts these days, I feel like I should say, and I want to say it, it would be very easy for me to do a provocative podcast about the gathering storm with specific demands about what needs to be done, demanding this, that, and the other thing, and backing up people that I agreed with. This is the standard path that podcasters and talk radio people are told to take because you want to provoke a reaction. But in the wake of ISIS taking a major city in a major province of Iraq, Ramadi, a place Americans fought and died for, a place where Americans were maimed defending freedom for the people of Iraq, or so we were told, I don't think ginning up support for a strategy, especially an armchair strategy, as it would be, serves anyone. This is something I have a lot of passion for because what I am seeing and what is happening in the world worries me deeply. More importantly, what I see our so-called leaders doing and saying about what is going on in the world worries me even more. Now, before I get into this, I want to talk about xgovernmentcars.com. First of all, xgovernmentcars.com is having a grand reopening event. They have nicer, newer vehicles because Ed Johnson, the owner, has a line on where to get the good cars and trucks. They've got Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, plus they got a new shipment of Expeditions, all kinds of trucks, vans, and SUVs. And here's the main thing. Great financing for all levels of credit, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Everyone's approved. So we're talking about kick-ass cars, one owner, professionally maintained government and fleet vehicles, and cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson. Also, 3-day satisfaction guarantee, financing for all levels of credit, and you can apply online safely and securely 24/7 at xgovernmentcars.com. And if you want to check out the cars, the weather's great. I was over there today. We had to replace one of the lights in the podcast ambulance, and that was really cool. And I think I really disrupted. I really disrupted business over there. But you should really check it out. It's fun to go to xgovernmentcars.com. Still has the Crown Vicks, the Impalas, the Chargers, and the trucks as well. 2420 Nevada Avenue North, Golden Valley, Minnesota. Don't forget the grand reopening event is on now at xgovernmentcars.com. Everything is better at
xgovernmentcars.com.
So let me set the stage if you weren't aware of what happened over the weekend. Just this weekend, it was announced that U.S. Delta Force commandos killed a major ISIS leader in a raid on his headquarters, captured his wife, who was also supposedly an ISIS operative, and killed a number of ISIS operators, and also recovered a slave of the wife and husband, ISIS people. The news of this U.S. operation inside Syria was greeted with unabashed gushing by every single mainstream news network and many news outlets online. It was touted as a major blow to the so-called Islamic State. Then, at the end of the weekend and the beginning of this week, so this would have been the week of May 18th or 16th or 15th, 2015, ISIS besieged the town of Ramadi in the Anbar province, about 70 miles from Baghdad, the capital of Iraq, and captured it. So we have a situation where the perfumed princes in Washington announced a special operation and talked about how great it was that the U.S. could do this surgically and no U.S. personnel had been killed, and how we uncovered a treasure trove of documents and disk drives and computers, and how it's great news. And it is great news. But it was also clearly communicated that the Obama administration considered this a major blow to ISIS. And I did a podcast, I guess it was Friday, and I said, so I would have done that Thursday morning. And I said, you know, normally I would talk about this, but I think I'm just going to wait because the other shoe is going to drop. Well, the other shoe was that ISIS not only captured Ramadi, but routed the Iraqi army, which was trained by the U.S. with a much smaller force. the Iraqis didn't just retreat, they ran pell-mell to safety without destroying tons of brand new U.S. military hardware, including tanks, anti-tank missiles, mortars, Humvees, ammunition, and other transportation equipment, and God knows what else that we've given them to defend themselves with or to conduct these, whatever you would call them, offensives. Now, sources here called it a retreat. Retreat is a valid military tactic. It's something that armies do to survive, to retreat, wheel around and counterattack, things of that nature. There's no dishonor in a retreat if it's handled properly. But armies in retreat, in order, generally destroy anything that could be used by the enemy. So, for example, when the British retreated from Burma during World War II, they blew bridges and things of that nature so that the Japanese couldn't use them. Armies in a rout drop their weapons and run like hell, leaving anyone who can't run and all of their equipment behind them, which the British also did in their departure from Burma, and some of the Chinese armies, as well as the Indians, when they left Burma in World War II, as an example. This is actually the greatest example, is what happened in Ramadi. What is the takeaway with this? Well, I could go on for an hour, but the bottom line is, whatever strategy was conducted or concocted by the Obama administration to deal with the Islamic State, whether it's airstrikes, using special forces here and there, whatever they're doing, clearly is not working. It is a failure, plain and simple. No matter what they do, it would be putting lipstick on a pig, to quote the president. And before you think that I'm only criticizing President Obama, I don't hear any Republicans, especially those running for office, suggesting anything that's close to workable as a strategy to deal with this problem. I am extremely disappointed in the media, both television and talk radio and online media. And I'm also disappointed in the Republican Party and our elected leaders of both parties in the present situation, because from where I sit, all of them are looking like charlatans. Now, very quickly, what's a charlatan? Well, the word apparently comes from a town in Italy, Cerrito de Spoleto, which was known for its wackiness and the quirkiness of its natives. It can mean a person falsely claiming to have a special knowledge or skill, a fraud, or a person practicing quackery in order to gain fame or money. What do you think the so-called presidential candidates are? What does their behavior suggest to you, whether it's Lindsey Graham, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush? You could go on and name almost all of them. To name a small percentage of the people touring the country, running around, running their mouths, and generally fiddling literally while Rome burns. People ask, why are there so many candidates? Because I believe you can get very famous and raise a lot of money and your street cred, gaining yourself a show on one of those cable channels when it's all over. That's why. And I think that goes for Mike Huckabee, and it goes for a lot of these candidates who are going to get 1% of the vote in the first primaries. And the media plays into the game for the same reasons. Now, we can argue all night about whether 50 or 38 or 46 Republican candidates for president is a good thing or a bad thing, but to me, it suggests a very decadent, dangerous situation when we're staring at some potentially serious problems economically and over the world. In addition, I haven't heard a single person clearly define what the problems are and his or her solutions or even a strategy right now. It's all positions, preening, media appearances, or political groupies who run out and raise money from dumb people who happen to be rich, or rich people who happen to be smart and know that to make these kinds of politicians do what you want them to do, you have to buy them. That's the kind of situation that we're in right now. And to be quite honest, from my reading of history, these kinds of situations never, ever end well. Now, I've talked about the economy in another podcast, and to review, just on the economy issue, I don't think even the so-called experts understand what's wrong with this economy or how to talk about the economy, and I don't think any of the politicians out there have the first clue about how to fix it. A lot of the moderate Republicans' positions is, well, we're going to do a better job. We're going to be better stewards of the government than the Democrats. The Democrats' position is, you know, how dare these rich people make money? We're going to take it away from them and give it to the poor people. If I had to guess where the so-called Black Swan event, the event that changes the course of history, will come from. You know, the earthquake or Pompeii, I would have to say it will be the economy. But coming in at a strong second is the deepening chaos in the Middle East. Here again, no one knows how to define the problem, whether it is a problem, and so nobody really knows how to suggest a strategy to solve it. Now, I'm not going to do that now. I refuse to say, here's what we should do. And it isn't because I'm afraid to say what I think we should do. I'm so tired of people saying, commentators saying, this is what we should do. I want to hear our leaders say, this is what we should do. But I can say some things that should be said, and no one is saying them. So here's I'm going to start with this. First of all, what's done is done. And if I hear one more politician say, this is what I would have done in 2003, or I made a mistake, or one more media harpy asked the question, would you have supported such and such back in 2003, I'm going to scream. Second, winners don't blame problems on previous leaders. Everybody knew Jimmy Carter was a bad president in 1979, but you didn't hear much talk about Carter after he lost a second term bid and Reagan became president. And by the way, President Carter wasn't evil and he wasn't corrupt. He was very, earnest about what he was trying to do. He just wasn't a very good leader. Reagan didn't talk much about him after he became president. He moved on and solved problems, creating a few of his own along the way. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't recall much talk about Jimmy Carter after January of 1981. Third, it will always be true in policymaking that whatever you do, there will be consequences to be managed going forward. At the end of World War I, the Treaty of Versailles set the stage for World War II. This is high school history. At the same time, the fall of the Ottoman Empire broke the status quo in the Middle East. During World War II, the Germans and the Japanese planned to link up through the Middle East, and fighting there further set the stage for the kinds of conflicts we have seen since the 1950s. Perhaps we might not have wanted to be in North Africa, but we had to, because if they had been able to link up, it would have meant that the Germans and the Japanese would have controlled all of those resources. So hence you see the importance geographically and in terms of resources of the region. Now, we all know the peculiar nature of the fighting in World War II. The Russians losing 20 to 30 million people, eventually occupying Eastern Europe. The Russians beating the U.S. to Berlin created a situation which we have now referred to in history as the Cold War. The Cold War drained budgets. It caused wars and all sorts of meddling by both sides. And the takeaway is, nothing is ever completely solved. People can scream and yell and pound. They can be realists. They can be idealists. They can be liberals. They can be conservatives. They can be populists. They can be communists. They can be fascists. They can be whatever they want to be. But once a direction has been proposed, voted on, and set, then it is implemented. And when it is implemented, there's going to be mistakes made, and successes and problems are going to grow from those mistakes. And sometimes, especially, problems grow from the successes. So when Lindsey Graham and John McCain go on about directly confronting ISIS, they want you to believe that this is going to, quote, solve the problem. But it won't. It's going to create new problems, even if it's successful. And you're going to have to be okay with the new problems even success will create. It doesn't matter who has been president. We have had some successes and failures, but mostly failures when we talk about the Middle East. The U.S. did not start the problems in the region, and some might even argue that the U.K. did not start the problems in the region. But the fact is, there are real problems in the Middle East. Clan and tribe are the controlling social authorities, not government. And while people who live there are human beings, you know, their social structures do not bear any resemblance to American social structures and probably never will. Many of the countries of the Middle East, even when we talk about developed allies like Jordan and Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Algeria and Morocco, are in worse economic conditions than African countries that we've regarded as basket cases for decades. And they can't hold a candle socially, militarily, economically to the U.S., Europe, Japan, South Korea, which was even worse conditions after the Korean War, Taiwan after World War II, same situation. China after World War II, same situations. And now it's the second largest economy in the world. Japan, Turkey, Malaysia, Singapore. The countries I'm talking about in the Middle East, many of them are starting to slip back and lose ground. While there have been tribal conflicts in the region for hundreds of years based on grievances and issues, probably they don't even remember, today's internecine fighting is transmitted and amplified into our world through the use of terror tactics and modern media. So we can't ignore it anymore, even when we probably should. So what are the facts? Well, the U.S. has a history of major blunders, which have cost us dearly. And just to give you three or four, examples. But before I do, I'm going to tell you that these examples have been picked and worded in such a way to be biased in various ways, because there's whole schools of thought on all of these things. So it didn't start with Carter, and it didn't end with Obama, okay? But just to give you some examples of mistakes or blunders in foreign policy that we've made for whatever reason at the time that had to be managed going forward and have caused problems down the line, Carter picked the wrong horse in Iran, Reagan pulled out of Lebanon, Clinton passed on a chance to assassinate bin Laden and ignored the potential threat of al-Qaeda. Bush overreacted to 9/11, thought he could invade, occupy, and remake key governments in the region as democracies, in other words, intervention, forward intervention, except he told the American people a different story, and they will probably never forgive him for that. The president we currently have, President Obama, pulled out of the region almost completely, precipitously, relying on cutting deals with dictators and bad actors without really making them earn it, in the process losing the support of key allies and upsetting decades-old power arrangements in the world because now our allies don't trust him. And I don't know when we finally see the results of this foreign policy if the American people will ever forgive Barack Obama for doing this. But no one, not a single Republican, not a single Democrat, can answer the simple question, what is our foreign policy? The president can't answer that question. The Republicans can't answer that question. And they also can't answer the question, what should our foreign policy be? Not a single media person, reporter, commentator, screaming head, talk radio person, media harpy is able to ask the key question of any of these candidates, what is your foreign policy going to be and what should the foreign policy of the U.S. be? And it doesn't matter because I don't think any of them could answer the question. And what's worse, fed a steady diet of Carl's Jr. and Fox News alarmism, the American people don't even know where Ramadi is unless they had the misfortune of serving there. But they also know that Hillary Clinton was in a diner this morning in Waterloo, Iowa, eating breakfast with about 10 people surrounded by scores of reporters, cameras, and shouted questions. Ridiculous. What do I think is going to happen in the Middle East? Well, my second place candidate for the Black Swan event, as I've told you, for ISIS, is for ISIS, ISIL, Daesh, or whatever John Kerry calls it this week, to overrun Iraq and for a civil war to start there, spreading chaos through the region as ISIS builds a state. Actually, I think we're probably pretty close to that happening unless the United States sends troops to back up the Iraqi army, and that is not going to happen with this president. What is ISIS? A lot of people don't understand that it was formed by a group of former Ba'athist and Sunni Saddam loyalist officers who were imprisoned together and who were released after the United States left in reaction to the Shiite power overreach of the first Iraqi government after the war. So these guys were Sunnis who were jailed and either they got out on a prison break or they were released. ISIS is as much about organization as it is about religious fanaticism. These are officers, military officers running this. They use fanaticism to recruit and further their goals. People in the U.S. are constantly told this is a fanatic religious group, and it is. But it is also a tribal, cultural, and regional and military organization. And at the same time, it is structured a little more like al-Qaeda in that it's more flexible than an actual government. They are well-armed, they're well-led, they're combat experienced, and have demonstrated an ability to replace leaders that they've lost, who sometimes turn out to be better than the ones that were there before. Most of the people that we see in the news are not really the leaders. They are figureheads. The real leaders remain behind the scenes. So ISIS is hard to figure out because a lot of people don't understand the origins of it. Now, my understanding is that President Obama was warned about this, but he did nothing, and his reaction was to call it the JV team, when in fact it's anything but the JV team. This is a group of, as I said, combat veterans, as such as they are, experienced leadership, you know, generals and colonels and majors and things of that nature, fueled on religious fanaticism and manipulated by religious fanaticism, using terror to scare people into running rather than fighting. So when we get into this, you start to say, well, you know, we've got to stop this. This is terrible. This can't go on. We're losing Iraq. How do we stop ISIS? And then as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking, first of all, is that even the right question? And I'm not saying that we think what ISIS is doing is great, but do we want to stop them? After all, they are the enemy of Iran and Bashar al-Assad. Aren't they our enemies? Isn't Assad and Iran our enemy, or are they our friends? You see how confusing the foreign policy of the United States is? Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states are 80 to 90% Sunni, and they have supported Sunni efforts to depose Assad in Syria, which is where a lot of this started. So are we supposed to go fight on the side of Iran and the Shiites? And if we don't, will the Shiite militias, which is they are fueled and commanded by the Iranians, move into the Anbar province, thus forming a Sunni resistance, which will side with ISIS? So the question of whether we should be picking a side, invading, sending troops, you know, launching airstrikes and everything else is a huge question. And by the way, the Iraqis retreated even with U.S. airstrikes. So really the question is, where do you come down on military intervention? Is the United States the police force for the world? Is forward intervention or early intervention in a potential conflict the right thing to do to avoid a potential world war? The lesson of forward intervention is that if we had intervened in World War II early, perhaps we could have avoided World War II, right? If we expect our military to accomplish these missions when we say we're going to invade, we're going to set those people straight, then why do we give them rules of engagement rather than allowing them to use all of their resources to fight to win total victory and use all of our power when and if we engage so that we are able to dictate the peace terms, letter and verse? Here's another question. Are we supposed to defend Europe and also counterbalance the Chinese and the Russians? And how far are we supposed to go? The Russians have taken two or three regions. Yeah, they took Georgia, they took Crimea, and they took part of the Ukraine. Are we supposed to send troops in there to stop that? Where does Europe begin to defend itself? And what about China? What about Japan? What about Latin America and other parts of Asia? What about Israel? How far do we go to defend Israel on the other side of the Middle East? Do you expect the United States to solve the problems in the Middle East, as intractable as they are? Which is really, on the Israeli-Palestinian side, it's a few hundred settlements and a few hundred thousand people. The standard response since the Clinton administration is, as I said, these are early interventions based on our experience in World War II to prevent larger wars from being started. But do interventions in a multipolar world actually work? So we've seen the spread of Al-Qaeda or the spread of ISIS into Yemen and Libya and the Middle East. So where do we intervene? Do we intervene in Libya? Do we intervene in, what do we do? And quite honestly, we did intervene in Libya, and we did intervene in Iraq to stop this very kind of thing from happening, and it's happening. So it's a fair question to ask whether or not these military interventions work. And if we don't do military interventions, then what happens? And if you can't answer these questions thoughtfully, and with some level of awareness of the regions and the histories of the people that we're talking about, then you have a lot of homework. Nobody understood what Sir Lawrence was doing in World War I when the British defeated the Ottoman by using special forces tactics. But he understood because he was a student of the region. He understood the region. He spoke Arabic. He understood it. And so if you can't answer the questions about these people and what kind of society they have and what kind of people, how are the Iranians different from Iraqis and Saudi Arabians. You know, if you can't answer those questions and have a calm discussion with a person of any political persuasion about the right policy for the United States now and in the near future, then you have a lot of homework to do. I am not at the point where I'm going to say that a Democrat can't come up with a foreign policy idea that I like. And I am not in a position of saying that a Republican is going to come up with a foreign policy idea that I like. I don't like anything that any of them have said because I don't think any of them have a clue what to tell the American people should do. You know, I could say we should bomb them into the Stone Age. I've said it, you know, but saying we have to send troops or to bomb them or to do whatever to save the world from ISIS isn't going to do either. There's going to have to be a little bit deeper conversation about this. On the same token, responding by saying, did you support Bush or would you send your son or will you go, aren't helpful either because we're talking about foreign policy. We're not talking about debating and turning your finger on, to people and demanding that they agree with you. The fact is that we are entering a new time and a new world. And as this new world dawns, I cannot say this enough. The United States, most of Europe, most of Asia, and parts of Latin America are going to move forward very quickly. It has been happening very quietly for a while, but it's going to start to gather momentum now. I really don't think that those of us who grew up in the last century are going to recognize this new world at all. And some people, because of that, are going to have problems. And you're going to have people in you know places like the United States who are going to struggle with this. But there are also going to be places where people have struggled to form governments that work for their people, and it hasn't worked, and they're going to implode, and there's going to be chaos and pestilence and war, and people are going to starve, and it's going to get ugly. And I think that we're going to be surprised about where and when this kind of thing occurs and where it doesn't, and we're going to have to be prepared to decide whether those places and those situations are threats to the United States or not. To put it very simply, we are moving forward rapidly into the 21st century. Many of these places are moving backward or losing their grip and sliding down the cliff, and that's going to be a real problem. We have to be prepared to figure out how to deal with this. And the truth is, while we have seeded this world, we have spawned it going back to the Industrial Revolution, we have grown it, we have defended it, we've created it, the revolution is catching our leaders by surprise. And I'm here to tell you, I don't think they have a clue what to do. And neither do the rest of us. What do you think the response of people would have been as fascists gained power in Europe and Japan in the 1930s? If you ask people who were born in the 1920s and grew up during the 1930s, they'll tell you that people didn't really talk about it. They really didn't understand what was going on. You know, certainly there were German immigrants and there were second and third generation Italians. And, you know, they had various opinions about what was going on. But people really didn't talk too much about it because we were focused inward. We were focused on the economic situation. As a result, no one was prepared for what happened. I asked an economist once, well, you know, Bob, what's the worst thing that can happen? And he said, well, World War II, that's pretty much the worst thing that can happen. That was a worst case scenario, which in history, it all lays out very conveniently. I don't mean to bring up World War II so much, but these kinds of things, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, the Industrial Revolution, when you read history, these things piece together in perfect order and it falls like dominoes. Well, of course, we should have invaded, you know, Czechoslovakia and stopped Hitler. Of course, if we had done those kinds of responses were hardly obvious. You know, Neville Chamberlain made a huge mistake by appeasing Hitler, but he thought he was doing the right thing. You know, he didn't know. He was trying to keep the peace because he was thinking about World War I. He wasn't thinking about stopping World War II. So you can't know the future and you can't know what you're going to do. And so being prepared is going to require a lot of thinking. And in the process of doing this, our leadership is failing us. I don't think they're prepared. Our institutions are failing us. Our media is failing us. And we really aren't prepared today for what's going on in the rest of the world, and I think we need to get prepared. Now, as I said, I have purposefully avoided laying out a foreign policy in this podcast because I think all of us need to think about it and talk about it, at least with ourselves, before we need to say, this is it. But I can tell you that we should be demanding of people who are running for president because they think they can become famous, you know, to lay out a cogent, informed, academic foreign policy, not just saying we need to take the fight to ISIS, people who can actually debate and discuss foreign policy. I would certainly love to hear what people think we need to do and what our foreign policy should be. And you can send your comments to me through the comments or email section of the Bob Davis Podcast. And if you're involved in politics, if you're money raising, if you're bundling, whatever it is that you're doing, if you're a political groupie down in Iowa, you should be asking your elected leaders and people running, especially congressmen and potential presidential candidate, what's our foreign policy? And don't accept some nonsense. And then ask them what our foreign policy should be. We want specifics. We want to know where you would deploy, how much you would deploy, how you would deal with the Pentagon, how much you would spend. Why would you do that? Why should we intervene and stop ISIS when they are really fighting the Iranians? How do you stop the Iranians from getting nuclear weapons? Do you want to? What is forward event intervention? And if they can't answer those questions, they should be pilloried for it. They should be asked specific questions. And I'm not talking about just Tim Walz and John Klein and Eric Paulson and Tom Emmer and the rest of our congressional delegation in Minnesota, many of whom, especially the Republicans, wouldn't know an actual position if they had to take one, with few exceptions. I'm talking about Amy Klobuchar, who really wants to be the senator of small things, or Al Franken. What is our foreign policy currently? What are you supporting with our foreign policy? And what should our foreign policy be? And they should be required to answer it in a lot more than just bromides, like freedom and things of that nature, because this is what gets us into trouble. Because I'm telling you, this is coming. And this is this situation with ISIS, the situation in the Middle East, the situation in the rest of the world, the situation with Ukraine, these are all artifacts of this movement toward this new world that is being birthed, that is partially technology, it's partially economy, it's partially communications, it's partially the new generation, and it's scary, and it's multipolar, and it's difficult and complex. It's like three-dimensional chess, and we need to have leaders who understand this. So there's a lot more to this than what are we going to do about ISIS? So those are some things to think about. So thanks for listening to Podcast 371. I occasionally have to get this stuff off my chest, and I want to thank xgovernmentcars.com for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast for a long time. Don't forget, they're doing the grand reopening event. They have Chargers, Impalas, next-gen Fords, plus trucks, vans, and SUVs. He's got a couple of new expeditions over there. One of them's from the FBI. They are kick-ass. I'm telling you, they're great. Don't forget, everyone's approved for credit, and there's cash deals direct from owner Ed Johnson, financing for all levels of credit. Apply online safely and securely 24/7 at
xgovernmentcars.com.
Got to thank the digital sponsor of the Bob Davis Podcast.com, Mad K Studios, creating quality original automotive artwork. Mad K is going to be out at some of the antique auto shows this summer. I'm going to tell you more as we get closer to the events. Maybe the mobile podcast command studio will be there too. So look for Unit 8 because it's going to be out and about. Click on the banners for more information about these digital sponsors, as well as all the sponsors of the Bob Davis Podcasts. And thanks for listening on Stitcher.com, iTunes, or TuneIn, and Blog Talk Radio. There are two players. There's a Blog Talk Radio player and also a TuneIn player. And if you just, they're just another way to listen to the podcast. You click on that, it'll start playing the last podcast that I uploaded to either Blog Talk Radio or TuneIn. You can also listen to podcasts right on the page at the Bob Davis Podcast. And thank you guys for doing that. Thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, and following on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for the donations and supporting Mobile Podcast Command. What is that for? So you see the picture of the podcast ambulance, and then under that is a big donate button. What is that for? That is for you if you want to donate to really exclusively the Podcast Command unit. Sometimes I buy Komodo Dragon coffee, but most of the time, in fact, all the time, it's there for diesel fuel and for preparations to cover the 2016 elections. I'm going to be heading out again pretty soon. I'll tell you where. I love doing the on-the-road podcast. podcast. I think it's a great way to podcast, and I can literally take everything that's in the studio, put it in the vehicle. If you've been listening to the podcast, you know about that. I love this thing, and I really appreciate the donations that people have been putting out there, because diesel fuel is it has a 60 gallon tank, so it's not cheap to fill up, but it goes a long way on 60 gallons. I think I could probably get from here all the way to easily all the way to Chicago in 1 gallon or in one tank of diesel fuel in that thing. And it runs great. And again, thanks for your donations. The whole thing's been crowdfunded. I really appreciate the donations. I don't want to go on and on about it. Thanks for liking, sharing, favoriting, all that stuff on Facebook and Twitter and every place else. And thank you most importantly for listening to the BobDavisPodcast.com. Thanks for listening to Podcast 371.
Hey, baby. Come on in. I've been waiting for you. Sit down, relax. You know, I got a few things I've been thinking about, and I'd like to share them with you. I know things have been a little strained around here lately because of all the stuff going on outside the house, you know, the pressure, the job, all those things that can...